The web practices of blogging and tagging will be familiar to this audience, I imagine. So I might briefly just mention how these technologies catalyze the field of play in a common domain of social and political potentiality. Here we might even say that the architecture of the internet is at its most ethical in the Foucauldian sense. That is, it's structured as an open source. It's structured to maximize the terms by which the self can relate to itself, the self can give itself to itself, and give itself to others. At the time that I wrote this, the New York Times reported that an important lawsuit had been filed by Apple Computer in California. You may know this. Apple contends that confidential information about its product development has been published on various blogs, and that bloggers should not have the right to do so. At issue is whether bloggers can be forced to reveal the sources of their story, or whether they should be considered journalists and therefore protected from having to publish their confidential sources, as journalists are. As it so happened, the court has ruled in favor of Apple, but it suspends the question of what a blogger is, because they said that it's basically on property law that they were able to intervene. They said, well, the secrets were actually stolen property that belonged to Apple Computer, and therefore the bloggers can be forced to reveal their sources. But the question remains, right? What is a blogger, and how does blogging fit into, or not, into traditional concepts of the public and the private? If the court rules that bloggers are journalists in the traditional sense, it will mean that bloggers will enjoy the right of protection from having to publish their sources. But so what, right? The implications, I think, are wider than a mere protection. And the implications extend not just to freedom of speech. For instance, here's the larger issue. Should blogs be subject to, for instance, campaign finance regulations or other state regulations that just because they contain certain political commentary or provide links to a candidate's campaign contributions? One example. The danger, I think, here is that in legislating bloggers as journalists, bloggers will be more strictly defined as a juridical class or a kind of legal body, and this will open the door to further governmental or greater governmental regulation of the multitudinous bloggers. Antithetical to the blogging ethos. In effect, this is not, to be cynical, this is none other than the attempt on the part of a very centralized and hierarchized culture industry with huge multinational corporate backing to limit and control free speech on the internet. But it's more, right? With blogging, we're on the cusp of a different sort of communications revolution. The blogosphere is different because it is potentially everywhere at once, and its immediacy is interactive. It's deeply communal, and its readers are at once potential participants or authors. And these communications are almost impossible for the state or any other authority to censor or jam. Ex post facto lawsuits notwithstanding, right? In the meantime, communications circulate freely and they're dynamic. And the participant understands that the collective ethos, the glue that binds the multitude of bloggers together, forms a new kind of body politic that is never really in stasis. Another instance of this, just very briefly, is the use of cell phone technologies. In January of 2001 in the Philippines, with the civilian-backed coup of President Estrada, their cell phone SMS messaging was used to help mobilize the multitude almost spontaneously and immediately. For one final example, we might turn to Wikipedia as one online phenomenon that realizes what Virno calls the life of the mind, this general rhetorical being in common. Wikipedia is the online encyclopedia that any user can add to or edit. It is a common project leading to a common wealth of knowledge, a commonwealth of individual subjectivities whose knowledge becomes shared and converges virtually. Yeah, this may not look like much, but like the blogosphere, it represents a radical reversal of age-old hierarchies, implicitly calling into question who is authorized to speak on a given subject, and how. Here we might imagine a new form of responsibility emerging, a new stewardship of information and knowledge, one that does not have recourse to centralized, top-down structures controlled by so-called experts. We have a new form emerging, a new form of trust in which we're shifting from the power of the few to the power of the many. Now we might start to say, those who earn our trust do so, not based on their credentials, but based on something that's established in non-traditional ways. In closing, I suggested a moment ago that we might think of the ball in the soccer metaphor as a quasi-technology, as that site where the multitudinous forces are catalyzed and converge. Neither subject nor object in the traditional sense, the ball is a technology much like language is when we are sensitive to the necessarily rhetorical dimensions of linguistic performance. Language, too, mobilizes a game in or on a field of play. It's the original technology that catalyzes a dynamic relation between life and art, bios and techne, nature and culture, between being and human symbolization, between words and things. And as we saw from Foucault, this presumes a catalytic and dynamic relation between the self and itself, in the ways the self relates to itself and to others. Technologies mobilize the relational play between these terms rhetorically without collapsing them. In this space of difference, we find some purchase for critique and for social and political renovation, the reinvention of ethical life, I think. If there is a grammar of the multitude, it must work to open what de Man calls vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration. In other words, it must be free to invent forever new possibilities of being and becoming. Exegesis does say, then, if we can free ourselves from fundamentalist rhetorics, from the stale exegesis of mere words and things, as if they dazzled before our eyes with the fullness of being, they don't, and those who claim that are blind. In McLuhan's words, quote, with the exegesis of words or things, dialectic is stopped at the level of description or of matching signifier and signified. It continues, only the technique of resonant interplay of figures and grounds will make sense of metaphor, the basis of all words and speech, end quote. The resonant interplay is the figure, is the form of life, perhaps the only form of life, a striving, a becoming, a style of life that is always emergent and never fully coinciding with itself. Thank you. You know, some people have to dash out at 3 and I won't be offended for that.
Stuart, thanks very much for such a fabulous talk. It was really great. We have some time for questions, so who would like to get things started on? Brent.
Can I, would you prefer I stay seated? I'll stay seated.
I thought you were going to ask a question.
Make the camera work. Well, make the camera work.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask about, I think it's in the Gay Science, Nietzsche talks about the importance of giving style to one's character, and that it's a way of living dangerously. But it sounds as though, I mean, there's something very voluntarist about that, as though giving style to one's character is kind of standing back and deciding on sort of enhancing here and taking away there. So there's this way in which you talk about style that sounds fundamentally different to something that we're caught up in, but at the same time is something that we inherently or necessarily need to pay attention to. I'm just wondering if you could say a few words about both style.
Thanks, Brad. I think Nietzsche's giving Foucault a lot of material in this sense. And when Foucault says a style of life, he doesn't mean that we have a preconception of what we can become, right? For him, it's the whole point is the point I made about rhetoric. It's about suspending current definitions. So when he says that we have to have a style of life, that I have to have an ethical relation with or to myself, that I have to become other than what I am right now, it may be that I don't yet know what it is that I will become, right? And so I'm not working towards necessarily towards a goal. I might be just in the, I might just be saying no. I might be performing Bartleby in the sense that I'm saying no, I prefer not to. I'm not going to be this thing that you call me. In a wonderful interview from 82, Foucault's asked about being gay, and he says, I'm not gay. And of course everyone's like, what do you mean? Well, if you're not gay, then no one is, right? And he said, well, I'm becoming gay. And then he added, and hopefully I'll never get there. Right? So this idea that interview in question is very much talking about identity politics, right? It's like, I refuse the identity, I refuse the terms that you give me in which to live, and I refuse the identity that you put upon me. And I refuse, even moreover, I refuse to objectivize myself in those terms. I have to free myself from those and dare to create new terms and stylize new terms. So I see style as being fundamentally poetic, creative. And there's an interesting question of the will operating there, and whose will is it, and am I merely channeling the will of with some kind of rhetoric? I don't think you want that either, and I don't want that. So I don't quite know what to do with the will, with you. But I think the will has been troubled all along, right? I think the will has been troubled even in, there's a will operating in Descartes, which is very troublesome. Descartes has to use the will and then has to deny that there's such a thing as a will because it's all intellectual, right? But I have to will myself not to fall into error, he says. That's like, well, how would I do that? Well, the will would have to will the will. And that's more self-recursive than the self-recursive intellect that says, I think, therefore I am, because I have an idea, a representation of myself. So the idea that is so reflexive in Foucault, the rationality that's so reflexive in Descartes is even underwritten by a will that has to will itself not to will in order to know the truth. So the will is a mess, right? And it goes, you know, it's there's all kinds of religious questions there too. So you know, we'll just maybe leave that.
Thanks so much for your talk, Stuart. I really appreciate that. I'm wondering if you can clarify for me, though, because it seems as though your reading of Foucault through Masumi creates a lot of really interesting and challenging possibilities for thinking the multitude, this idea of a tension between goals. So something very nomadological about that, not fixed, definitely in movement, has a time as well as a place. But then when you shift to Birno, it seems as though you're getting back to the monad rather than the nomad, if that makes sense. Some sort of base from which things come out of. And that brings you back to just a space rather than the space-time of the movement that you have between the goals. So I'm wondering,
it's true.
I'd be interested to see you follow through your thinking of Masumi into your own version of the multitude rather than reverting, or not reverting, but
rather than just deploying Virno. Thank you. Yes, that's you're right. And it's Aristotle, thinking through Aristotle is limited in that sense that it's a thinking of space rather than a thinking of temporally as well. Virno insists that the multitude is, that the individuals that make up the multitude are sort of unheimlich. They're nomads. They're not at home. And this is one of those paradoxical moments. Like this not being at home and having nothing in common is the very thing we have in common, right? I mean, it seems like a kind of a cheap way of having a commonality. But I think there's a kind of truth to it, right? If you can recognize someone else's alienation, I mean, this and your own and have and share that experience. So. Yeah, thank you. I can't think through it right. That's a very good suggestion.
Hi. Maybe I need clarification on how self-reflections working in your account. I know that Foucault is often using reflexive verbs in that context, so it's thinking about oneself is used in a way that might not necessitate a form of self-objectification. So I guess what I want to know, or put my finger on more carefully, and perhaps I just missed it in your talk, is what are we doing when we transform ourselves, and whether or not you're committed to any kind of objectification. I guess I want to say, does there need to be anything there for Foucault? Is there, I mean, we use the term self, and that's like a noun,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that comes from our use of the first person pronoun, as though there's something behind that, and then we're struck to sort of objectify it, and then we do it in that way. You ask lots of questions of, well, what is it for the self to be looking at itself? We're in a terrible problem. But of course, I think about myself all the time. I don't have that problem because I'm not always caught in metaphysics when I just reflect. So maybe you can tell me a bit about what you think Foucault thinks, or maybe what you think about that.
I'd rephrase, I think, what you said in terms of identity. Say, well, when I objectivize myself, it means that I'm identifying with or as a particular group or as a particular way of being that I find in the world, right? And Foucault says, well, you know, that has its place as well. I didn't focus on that because it's like, if he says, if you find your identity in an identity politics, and you find your group, whether it's, you know, being gay in a particular way or what have you, it's like, that's fine, but he's interested, I think, in opening up possibilities, and I think this is the moment of critique, is rather than getting stuck in that sort of circular logic, he wants to think somehow outside of that, and that means creating new terms or deploying old terms from the Greeks, for instance, as new ways for us of being. So I would say that the kind of self-objectivization that you're talking about, I think, is not precluded from, it goes hand in hand with the effort to refuse those terms that we are as well, depending on what part of your life you're talking about. I mean, which self is at issue right now? I don't know if that starts to get at it, but I'm not precluding the kind of self-identification that is sort of rooted in a grammar or in the rules or in the way of being. But it's, there has to be the understanding as well that it's never a static thing, that even that sort of identification is always subject to renewal or renovation or something new coming from outside. So I don't know if that begins to answer.
Well, I guess my question is there anything there when I reflect for Foucault?
Oh, is there a substance?
I don't think so. Is he committed to anything when I reflect that I'm going to find anything? That there's any fact?
Well, you'll find things that you've put there, right? And he's not Freudian, but I mean, I would think of Freud here and think, well, the ego is just an agglomeration of, you know, failed attempts at love, right? In a certain sense, that it's this an historical sort of accretion of various attempts or various interactions with others and with myself and with the world and so on. It's definitely historical. There's something there. Is it a substance? You know, in the Cartesian sense of a res cogitans, as thinking stuff. Not that's free from, not as it is in itself, I wouldn't say, no. Not that's free from social and historical instantiations and so on.
Maybe you find all those socks that are missing.
What's that?
All the socks that go missing in the laundry, that you find when you reflect.
I just have a question associated with the metaphor that you used in assuming with the soccer ball game. I guess mine is associated, because within that it seems like you need the two teams and the technology of the ball to create this play in the field. I guess my question would be more towards what would happen in the sense of a bodily practice that's more engaged with like a self-centeredness, like dancing, for instance, that, you know, is a stylized practice, but it doesn't seem to fall into the same, like, I think it still falls into the same parameters of play between different intakes that cause you to create a new style of a dance or whatever.
Right, and in which case the body itself is the quasi-technology that's being used to create a new self. And it's just, of course, dancing is kind of highly social, right? You might be dancing alone in your room to work on your style, but there's usually a mirror there. I mean, it's always an act to be seen, I think, in that sense. It's highly social, but you're right, there doesn't have to necessarily be a thing as a technology. A technology can be, for Foucault, the Catholic confessional is a technology of the self, right? So it's an ideology can be a technology as well, as a way of making subjects, way of subjectivizing subjects in a particular way. Dancing is a great way, right? I mean, we dance for various reasons. We dance to celebrate, we dance, there's religious ritual, there's all kinds of dance, right? And these embody, I think it's a wonderful example, these embody various different ways of being, from expressing religious admiration common sociality, or an extremely sexualized way of being, and so on. So.
Is Jerick, I asked a question?
Yes, I'm afraid.
No.
You've been reading before everyone else.
We'll find it again.
No, but it's not from reading, it's from listening to your talk today. And it's just a really basic question, because I was really swept away in enthusiasm for assume these parables, the virtual and this wonderful field of sports and things, I guess. Then I had this kind of nagging thought in my mind. So I thought, well, it's really discordant with my sense of what's happening in the political culture within which we live. At the same time, I felt like a rat for even thinking such an idea, so I tried to suppress it. So I thought, well, who am I to stand against Hart and Negri and Spinoza and Brno, this happy, utopian, bouncy field of sports? And I thought, is it possible that there are bad multitudes, and that something like a bad multitude would begin to flesh it out much more accurately, describes the physiology of calcified subjective fascism of the somewhat like the culture we live in. And I thought it begins with the field of sports itself. I just thought, well, I've been this way with Lyotard and just gaining. I followed Foucault through his magnificent loss as he moved from history of sexuality to 5 years of not writing, goes through, you know, physiology of crisis, comes out in the care of the self, and I sort of depart Foucault at that point. And so I went back to this notion of the field of sport. I thought, well, is life actually a sport? And I thought, well, as far as I can see, it's not. Because there are no fixed rules in terms of subjectivity. There's no necessary equivalence of power. At the end of a game, people are still standing. In life itself, people tend to die. Sports have referees. Life itself has automatic classificatory forms of economic distribution called race, class, and gender, which operate anonymously. The political theory that I would go to today is not even being written by political theorists anymore. It's like the young writer I've been reading, Richard Morgan, sci-fi dystopian novelist, writing things like Altered Carbon and Market Forces. You know, where if you want to get a promotion, you get your car and you go out and kill your opponent on the streets and things like this. So when I thought about those things, I thought, well, is it possible that, in fact, the notion of the grammar of the multitude is correct, but it's already been flipped? The polarity has been flipped. And that grammar really does describe, you know, like an incipient, enthusiastic reaction formation not interested so much in artifice in terms of pure relationality, but interested really in what a lot of thinkers have thought about that you've quoted today, and so eloquently and so well. Nietzsche's the will to will. Heidegger's reading after Nietzsche of consummated nihilism. Or Hannah Arendt in The Life of the Mind, when she says, begins to speak in a really depressing preface to that book. You know, her last text at the end of her life, of really the meaning of the will to not will itself, you know, where the will becomes inert in itself. Is it possible then that the grammar of the multitude becomes popular and has resonance because it's describing exactly its opposite? It's describing, in fact, the sovereignty of the bad multitude as the essence of political existence today.
Sorry.
Is that
well, first of all, Hart and Negri would say there's one multitude, right? Just as there's one empire. Vierno leaves that open, and I would say that the Al-Qaeda terrorist network is a multitude. It functions as a decentralized, multitudinous, networked machine that has a kind of tremendous and powerful and very agential effect, right? So that's one kind of multitude. The other kind of multitude, to be happier multitude, would be people getting together to protest the U.S. invasion of Iraq, for instance, around the world. I mean, those images, when you start looking at them, I feel a deep melancholy looking at images from as far away as Melbourne and seeing a million people gather. I mean, it's like unbelievable. And then thinking, how could this not have had any sort of effect at all? But I think the jury's still out. I'm not sure that it hasn't or will not have an effect or is not having an effect by changing the way that we think of ourselves as global citizens. So I think that the change is more subtle. Yes, the multitude is maybe not so happy, and that's why I read it alongside of Foucault, because the project is forever has to be placed in one where we're always ethically questioning ourselves. And so there's, and Vierno points this out as well, it's like there's the real danger that it can be taken and used against us and used for unethically as well. So that sort of critical mode of questioning ourselves and always suspending those logics and putting into play other possibilities frustrates people as well. It frustrates Foucault's critics because it's not a prescriptive ethics, right? It doesn't say, oh, well, we should do this and we should always fight terrorists because they're bad and so on, because, I mean, America has a history of terrorism too that hasn't been sold as good. But it means that we always suspend the good and the evil questions and always ask ourselves those ethical questions. And I think that's what Foucault can bring to this discussion, is perpetually asking ourselves to think about the very fears that you you express.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that doesn't give us a very satisfactory answer that you can take to the bank, but it's a type of answer that will have an impact, I think, for the kind of subjectivities that we're becoming.
So can I ask you just to post a little quick little thing? Because that's a really good response. And it's like liberal humanism, it's sort of advanced, and it's ethical and it's serious. But is it possible with that word Foucault went wrong? Is that culture left him? Because culture is not about the care of the self. It's about what something Nietzsche saw much earlier, is that people want to get rid of themselves as fast as possible. They in fact want to gut themselves, and it accounts for, I thought that insight accounts for a lot of the popular culture within which we live. And why in fact you'd have the energies of the bad, you know, what I would call the bad multitude, I don't know what to describe it, the Martha Stewart multitude. Or the multitude that would give three cheers to George Bush this morning as he announces at Wolfowitz, you know, the devil incarnate is now going to be head of the World Bank. Those kind of things, and you know, the cheers go on, or Bush says there'll be no exits, U.S. exit strategy from Iraq and things like this.
The new exit strategy from Iraq through Iran.
Yeah, but all like real congealment of subjectivity and popular approval. You can feel the energies itself. So I think the language of the multitudes can be taken really seriously, but let's get serious about it and not park it over in utopia.
Oh, it's not parked. It's an injunction. I mean, it's definitely an injunction.
Okay.
I mean, this is it's to be realized as a project, which is part of what communication does as well, part of what part of what we're doing here as well, having this conversation.
But Stuart, just one thing. I mean, it's a lot. But even bloggers, right? Because bloggers are really great. But then I think, well, who are the most effective bloggers on the net these days? Mm-hmm. Who in the last U.S. election? Who are the most effective bloggers? It certainly wasn't the left, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. The most effective blogging was coming from the right. I mean, they were writing like BitTorrent.
Well, that's because they've done a lot better job than the left at mobilizing the what Demand calls the referential aberration, and this is. That when you mobilize and get people to believe that George W. Bush equals a vote for Jesus, as one sign says, then you've really then that's the dangerous side, right? It's true. Then you're mobilizing rhetorical devices for they were better at that, and so you've got to be strategic against that.
Just to continue with the bad multitude idea, or the lynch mob multitude, that would be a reaction of many people to that. I just wonder, like, are they suggesting that multitude can be a way of escaping state sovereignty? Like, isn't there any way that this, like, I wonder if, like, the new model for state sovereignty is, like, this, the sort of Republican dispensationalist end of the world, like, that reflects this popular clamoring to have the state be involved in what happens at the end of the world, what happens in the afterlife. So that then the multitude is suddenly no longer separate from state sovereignty.
And this is the ultimate form of biopolitics, right? It's like life everlasting. This is what we're selling you. You're right. I mean, I think Hart and Negri especially say that, well, the old-fashioned state is on the run and it's no longer. I mean, now we're talking about empire, but then there seems to be a redoubling of sort of centralized and hierarchized and mega machinic kind of state sovereignty coming from the U.S. So it's that empire. It seems to be a lot of more of the old-fashioned same thing, but this time with a lot of Jesus thrown in. You know, someone's Jesus anyway.
Someone's Steve. Other questions? Comments?
We're gonna start putting people on the spot. Come on down.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just pretty serious. Fantastic presentation, and it's just really great.
Thank you.
Just welcome. Thank you.